Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast number 9, Indigenous Worldviews, a conversation with Lloyd Hansen. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. In this conversation, we explore Indigenous worldviews as a pathway toward regeneration. We talk with Lloyd Hansen, a humble, curious, and wise person who has earned the privilege of being called a 21st century Renaissance man. He was raised by a minister whose focus was love and social justice. As a young man, he became intrigued by the work of Joseph Campbell, which led him to recognize that there were different perspectives possible in seeing and experiencing the world. At age 51, Lloyd was introduced to Peruvian shamanism and began his exploration of Native American wisdom. This profoundly shaped his consciousness and informed his life. For the last 2.5 years, Lloyd has been exploring the work of theoretical physicist David Bohm. This work, along with other studies, has Lloyd saying, "Everything is about relationships and everything is related. Becoming fully human is doing the inner work to create and nurture these relationships. Transformation emerges from wholeness." And now I would like to introduce the host of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, Dr. John Izu and Alain Gauthier.
Hello, I'm Dr. John Izu, and on behalf of my co-host Alain Gauthier and our producer Jim Burke, I want to welcome you to this episode of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we explore together how humanity and society needs to change and adapt to have a positive way forward for people and for planet. Welcome, and we're glad that you're joining us today. Alain, I'm excited about this conversation today, where we're going to be talking about Indigenous wisdom and how it might inform our way forward. But maybe even more profoundly to me, it's a conversation about paradigms and the way a paradigm of an entire culture can influence the future as well as the present. So today we're really going to be talking about some of the paradigms that have guided Western culture and how they may serve us or not serve us in terms of the way forward and perhaps how we have to adapt. And I couldn't help but think of when I was in China just before the pandemic and walked a rather remote part of the Wall of China. And what occurred to me there was that this is a public works project that took several millennia to do. The Wall of China, we think of it as a tourist attraction, but it was built over about 1600, 1700 years as a public works project to both create a trade route and to keep the Mongolians from invading from the north. And it occurred to me when I was there that there's no equivalent in Western civilization. There literally is no such thing as a several thousand year public works project for the public good, because we tend to be very short term in our thinking. So I use that only as an example of the way that culture and paradigms can influence society. And even today, China has a 60 year plan, and the United States and Canada hardly even have a plan till the next election. I know we're not going to talk about China today, but I think this idea of really looking at our paradigms and what we might learn from other paradigms besides the one that guides us really excites me today. And Alain, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you, John. Yes, I'm very interested in this conversation as well. And Lloyd and I have been talking for a number of months now about what are some of the contrasts between the Western dominant worldview and the indigenous, or also called kinship and sometimes partnership worldview. And Lloyd has been very active in that domain. So we're going to invite him now. And Lloyd, welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask the first question, which is, what is in your life has led you to explore in depth what we Westerners can learn from Indigenous wisdom and quantum physics, because you have also looked into that?
Well, I hadn't realized until we started talking about these things, but one of the real seminal moments in my life was when I was about 14 years old. I happened to hear Joseph Campbell on a radio interview. And of course, at that time, I had no idea who Joseph Campbell was. But brought up as a minister's son, I was very interested in his stating that he had observed that the Middle Eastern religions are different from all the other religions in the world. The Middle Eastern religions see the world as a struggle between good and evil. So judgment and judging everything as good or bad is a way of life for the people who live under those Middle Eastern religions, whereas all the indigenous religions and all the Eastern philosophy religions, the definition of the good life is to live in balance and harmony with all around you. And for me at age 14, it opened up the door to see that there are different ways of experiencing and seeing reality. And that, as I said, at the time, I had no idea how big that was. But for me, that has been the track of my life. For many years, I had a t-shirt that has the visage of Albert Einstein on it. And the caption at the bottom said, "Looking for the order." And that's what my life has been.
So from that viewpoint, what are some key aspects of the dominant Western worldview that may account for the predicament we are in now, including the climate crisis, of course?
I think probably the primary one is that we have grown up in a worldview of separation. That is our story, that we are separate from one another. We are separate from the natural world. And that's evidenced even in our creation stories, because Genesis says man has been given dominion over the planet. And indigenous people look at it just exactly the other way, that humankind is the younger brother. We're the last ones to appear here. And without the cosmic realm, the planet wouldn't be here. And without the planet, there would be no soil. And without the soil, there would be no plants. Without the plants, there would be no animals. And without all of the rest of that, we wouldn't be here. So in our story, we place ourselves at the apex of creation, and indigenous peoples put us as totally dependent on everything else.
And so we see in some aspects of the modern worldviews and the modern world, the consequences of that. And what impact the monotheist religions have had on the way men have viewed and treating not just the earth, but also women.
I was just reading one of my favorite books and refreshing my memory on some things. And when the British came to North America, and it's interesting to see that the missionaries always went along with the soldiers in the colonization of the world. And so both the secular authorities and the missionaries, one of the very first things they did with the native tribes in North America was to refuse to allow women to have any position of power or any place in the negotiations, where in most indigenous tribes, women had equal power, and there were a number of tribes where the grandmothers had the final veto power over any decisions of the council. And so the women who have written about that said that the missionaries and the authorities recognized rightly that until you got the women out of the way, you were not going to be able to completely conquer the continent and take it over as you wanted to.
John?
Two thoughts came up. One of the really interesting things about the creation story in the Jewish scriptures is the word dominion that translates into English is actually not really a good translation of the Hebrew word, which is actually more akin to the same word that used to be a good or noble king. So that it is true that the Western religions have this idea of separation and good and evil, and I'm a big fan for decades of Campbell's work. Yet at the same time, so much of the misinterpretation of even the religion being abducted in a way by the power structure. And to your point, the missionaries got abducted into the power structure as much as the religion drove them there. So, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's written beautifully about Buddha and Jesus, that if you look at their core teachings, they're almost identical about how you live your life. Jesus was a radical. He was against power. He was in favor of the poor, taking charge, if you will. And even that word dominion actually is more like be a good steward. But you're absolutely right that this, while maybe some of the original, in my view, spirituality of both Jesus and of some of the early Hebrew beliefs got co-opted in the West by the power structure again and again. So eventually the popes really weren't religious people at all until you get to the modern era. Hardly any of the popes were actually very religious or spiritual at all. But it wasn't because so much, in my view, the religion was poisoned as much as the Western dominant male culture really molded the Western religions into their own image rather than the other way around. So I do agree with what happened. I'm not so sure it was as embedded completely in the spiritual traditions themselves.
Well, I agree with you completely on that, that for a long time, starting from when I was fairly young, I felt that the reason Jesus appeared in the Middle East is because their religions were so screwed up and they needed a fresh start. But I also think the church has to accept the responsibility. It is what its history has been. And from 300, when Constantine made it the state religion of Rome, it has been the religion of Western Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely agree. And that was my point, is that it, from that point on, the religion got co-opted by the power structure rather than the other way around, right?
Yes.
It's tragic, actually.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And Lord, you might want to say a little bit about what the doctrine of discovery, or the discovery doctrine, has done to the colonization of America, of the Americas, and in fact the whole world outside of Europe.
Well, the doctrine of discovery was from a papal bull in 1452, 1454, something like that. It was when the Europeans were starting their voyages of discovery. And the Portuguese had been traveling down the western coast of Africa and actually going around Africa and starting trade with India. And the Spanish wanted to get involved in it too. And the Pope didn't want these two Catholic countries fighting one another. And so the Pope issued this papal bull. And essentially, the division was in the New World. That's why Brazil is a Portuguese territory. They speak Portuguese in Brazil, and the rest of South America speaks Spanish, because the Pope divided up South America that way. And what the doctrine of discovery was, it was a follow-up to the, in a way, to the Crusades. And what the church decided in the Crusades was that anyone in the world who was not Christian was an enemy of the Catholic Church. And for what they considered primitive people, indigenous people, they were viewed as less than fully human. They were just brutes. And so what the papal bulls did was gave the Catholic countries the right to do anything they wanted to. It essentially set up the slave trade, and it set up the taking over of indigenous people's lands by these Christian countries. And what's interesting is that the doctrine of discovery, as I said, was originally for the Catholic countries. Well, the British knew a good thing when they saw it, so they adopted the doctrine of discovery for the areas that they colonized as well. And it didn't stop there. Is we have a Supreme Court decision in 1823 upholding the doctrine of discovery, which is a Christian doctrine, as the legal basis for taking indigenous lands in North America and for setting up the relationships between the government and the indigenous people, which one would think the First Amendment might have had something to say about that, but it didn't. That Christian doctrine is a part of the legal code of the United States.
From the indigenous perspective, what this frame of mind, this worldview that the colonizers were bringing with them, what has it provoked, and what are some remnants of it as you see it in the way indigenous people view how the West may have gone astray?
I'll share a story that, again, from this wonderful book by Rupert Ross. And Rupert Ross was a Canadian Crown attorney, and he got the opportunity to be part of the criminal justice system that administers law on the remote reserves in Canada. And he talks about a conference that he was at where there were Royal Canadian Mounted Police, there were people from the legal system, you know, lawyers and judges, and there were Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And there was a great deal of discomfort amongst the three, not just the Indigenous with the other two, but just as here, the police often don't like the attorneys, you know, the prosecutors. There's a lot of disagreement there. And so there was a lot of tension in the room. And this Ojibwe elder got up to open the meeting, and he prayed the traditional way that people do, and that his people did, and explained it. He says, when we pray, we look up to the sky, and we open our eyes and just look around at what's up there in this amazing world in which we live. And we open our arms with our hands out, offering gratitude and welcome for all that is up there. And we keep our eyes open the whole time we pray. And it seemed to work pretty well, because most of people lived pretty well on Turtle Island before the white people came. And then the missionaries came and told us, no, 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 you're praying the wrong way, that you're supposed to close your eyes and look down and put your hands in a teepee under your chin and keep your eyes closed and pray that way. Well, we thought, we'll try this out. So we did that. We bowed our heads. We put our hands under our chins. We closed our eyes and we prayed and prayed and prayed. And when we opened our eyes, we saw that all our lands had been taken. Our land was gone. And so we decided to go back to our old way of praying.
That's a wonderful, tragic, but wonderful story. A couple of thoughts popcorned in my mind as you were speaking. One is, interestingly, in the Irish mystic tradition, they actually prayed with their hands like this, looking up. So actually, once again, often in the mystic tradition in Christianity, it's actually more Eastern, or what we think of as Eastern. But one of the interesting things, one of our earlier guests, Janine Benuis, who's a biologist who wrote a number of books, including Biomimicry, talked about one of the things that is true of nature is that one reason that nature is learned to be regenerative and to kind of give back is because nature can't move. Plants especially, right? This is where the forest is. This is where these particular plants are. So they have to be in harmony and learn to adapt with each other, because they can't just go somewhere else. And one of the interesting things about most indigenous and hunting and gathering tribes didn't move around very much. So they naturally, just like the plants, tended to be in a harmonic or balanced relationship with nature. Whereas if you think about Europeans, the Europeans were the one, if you believe the evidence that life pretty much emanated in parts of Asia and in Africa and then went north, right? So that these were the people who left and went and traveled around. And so when you're not in one place, I think what Janine would say, it kind of drives you to, well, let's just go find another place we can conquer and take over. So I'm curious the way in which place may influence as well as paradigms, though I completely agree with you, the consequence, we just came and just took over and said, you know, you're barbarians. What could we learn from you? And, you know, one of the things I've learned in business is anytime you think you're the bomb and you know the truth, you're in trouble. And I think the Western tradition, by seeing all everyone besides us and every religion besides us as, you know, barbarians, meant we weren't open to learning. And even today, there are remnants of that, where there's a resistance to learn in the United States from other countries about things like healthcare, the same resistance that maybe when the Europeans arrived, they said, what could we possibly learn from these barbarians? You know, they don't have the technology we have. They must be primitive, as opposed to being curious about what we could learn from people who stayed in one place and learned to be in harmony with that place. Anyway, that's a lot of thoughts, but I wanted to throw some salad into the mix.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I agree with you completely on that, too, that yes, for every indigenous people that I've met or have read about on the planet, place is the most important thing for them. And place is not just real estate. Place, it's alive, and it's all the non-human elements of it. It's the rocks. It's the pattern of the rains that you get. It's the way the winds blow through. It's the ancestors who've been buried there and whose spirits animate the place. So place is this totality that we in West don't really have any comparable conception of.
Yeah, and also that we, in that beautiful book, Braiding Sweetgrass, the author talks about in the indigenous cultures, the words that were used for other species and other creatures were personal pronouns, mm-hmm. as opposed to things. And I was thinking about your thing, even about prayer. Popcorn came up for me that if you're praying like this, there's a sense that I'm a part of the divine. I'm a part of all of creation. Your head down is almost reinforcing your original idea of separation. I'm so separate from everything else. I've just got to bow down to it as opposed to be a part of it. So you begin to see the consequence of that separation idea in a whole variety of ways.
Very much so, yes. And that we have made the divine, that we made God separate from our world.
Yes, and from that viewpoint of separation, which you mentioned at the beginning, what actually could be some new embodied practices that would result from viewing ourselves as part or even children of the earth, rather than in controlling and exploiting the earth?
Well, there's so many places to go with that, but I think in many ways the one that connects most readily, especially with young children, as I've seen, is to get engaged in the planting of seeds and the growing of food. that children see the wonder in that. You know, I can put this seed in the ground, I water it, it gets sunshine, and in 3 months or 4 months, or depending on what it is, there's some things in a month, I can go out there and pick something and eat it from the ground. And they understand this wonder of Mother Earth producing all this food. And I know I love farmers markets. And in the fall, at harvest time, I'm always in awe and wonder at just the proliferation. There are so many sizes and shapes and colors and flavors. And I mean, clearly Mother Nature loves great variety and provides it for us.
Yes.
And I think the awe and wonder is probably the primary embodiment practice that we can do. Because if we walk about in awe and wonder, we're paying attention to what is there. We're present to what is there. And once we become present, then we start to see the relationships that exist and see how they relate to us and we relate to them. So what John talked about, these personal pronouns, so that we can begin to see the tree people and the rock people, as indigenous people talk about, and the water people, and recognize them as co-residents here on this amazing planet.
Yes. And I must admit that myself, the fact that I was able to help my father grow a few vegetables and flowers in the garden has very much stayed with me. And each time I was able to live in a house again with some garden, I would bring, you know, I would have a few garden beds like I have now in the back of my house. And I've always loved to be in nature, walking in nature, but also growing things. It's such an important aspect. And it teaches a lot about patience and observation and care. So I can see very much what you mean. Do you see any other practices that people, Westerners at this time, could espouse or go into that might help them develop that sense of wonder and care for nature?
Well, one practice that I invented for myself, and then I've since heard of other people using, you know, coming up with the same thing, is to find a tree. You can use various natural objects, but I generally use a tree. It works best for me. And just sit there and gaze at that tree and try to bring no thoughts whatever into your mind. Because the minute your mind says the word tree, you're interacting with that word, which is just symbolic of the reality that is there before you. And if you can sit there for 30 seconds or a minute or longer, if you practice, you can do it longer, but just be present to that amazing natural being that exists there. And in that way, you're experiencing the tree. You're not thinking about the tree. You're not interacting with the intellectual idea of what a tree is. You're just being present with that tree. And you can do it with flowers, you can do it with animals, but trees are large and they're quite stationary, so they work very well. But just the idea of getting out of our head and into our experiencing of what is there.
And I remember that you mentioned that language is important also, that the most Western languages are made mostly of nouns. I mean, they have some verbs too, whereas indigenous languages have more verbs than nouns, and the possibility to talk to trees in a way as a process of being with them. Can you say a few more things about that?
Yes, language does so limit to us. It's interesting. Over the last couple of years, I've studied David Bohm, one of the most brilliant theoretical physicists of the 20th century, who explored these ideas. And he was really taken with, why do we humans seem to be so incapable of dealing with our deep problems? And he got to language, and he was actually starting to develop his own verb-centric language, not realizing that that's what indigenous languages do. And the effect of our noun-based language, and I've been told that English has more nouns than any other language known in history, that we live in a world of things. And our classical science tells us that. The cosmology is that we live amongst these inert, dead things that have no meaning. And that's what our universe is. Whereas the indigenous peoples, with their verb-based languages, recognizing that everything is constantly in flux. Nothing is the same from one second to the next. And their language and their experience of reality conveys that to them. So, and I know I've talked this over with some indigenous peoples, and the first time I brought this up that I was made aware of this, the person thought for a minute and said, yeah, we can go hours without using a noun. And we English speakers can't begin to get into that. How can you go a minute without using a noun and talking with other people? So I fully appreciate that my indigenous friends live in a very different universe than you and I live in.
Well, we might shift to another domain, which I think you are very interested in and have studied, looked at, which is the domain of justice. And we are wondering what changes in the justice system could result from adopting a more indigenous perspective of healing and restoring balance and harmony in a community. So if you have some stories about that, that would be very helpful.
Well, as I was preparing for this, I was reminded that for Indigenous peoples, everything, literally everything, is about relationship. And they recognize that everything is related. And so this is an Eastern concept as well, too. So to live in balance and harmony is just to be aware of being in right relationship with everything that you encounter, with people, with the amazing planet, and with the non-human residents of our planet, even including, you know, the rocks and the waters and the trees. As for many Indigenous people, don't draw a dividing line between the animate and the inanimate. Again, because everything is in flux. You and I are alive today. We're both elders, so we're not going to be around all that much longer. And we're no longer, by Western views, we will no longer be a part of the sentient world. By Indigenous worldviews, we're just changing form and we'll be coming back. I mean, we do know that every atom in our bodies and every atom on our planet was created in stars, in the evolution, the forming, and then the destruction of stars. And so everything is a part of the life-giving process.
So how would that affect the justice system?
The justice system doesn't focus on what has gone wrong. And so frequently in our justice system, we're trying to affix blame so that we can punish someone. And our justice system is predicated upon punishment. And so often, the victims of our system, particularly in matters of sexual assault, are re-victimized by having to live through again the what went wrong and trying to explain. The Indigenous justice system is about healing. The whole thing is seen as a healing process. And there's no fixing of blame. There's no going over what happened to make sure we know exactly what happened. And the whole point is to restore the balance and harmony that has been disrupted. And their understanding is that anyone who breaks the harmony and balance in a village does so. There are only two reasons you can do that. One is you don't know any better. And if you don't know any better, punishment isn't going to deal with that. You need to learn what you need to learn. So we'll help you learn what you need to know. The other one is if you're sick. And I think particularly in our culture, we see so many people who have been grievously harmed and are sick with that trauma. And so if people are sick, you heal them. And again, Indigenous psychology is focused on healing. And so their whole world is about how can we heal so that we can live more in peace with one another.
And could you tell us a story that would illustrate that and how Indigenous people do this?
Yes. In 1988, in New Zealand, they adopted for the young people, for the 14 to 16-year-olds, Maori system of justice, which is community-based. And when somebody had offended, they brought in their family, their friends, the community. If you work, they bring in your boss. If you're on a sports team, they'd bring in your coach, just people who had a relationship with you in your life. And one of the stories that touched me so deeply is this 14-year-old girl was brought in, and her mother comes to the hearing just screaming at the girl and calling her a bitch and saying, you know, this is just such a waste of time. And just several minutes into the hearing, she stands up and yells and storms out. Now, I don't remember what this young girl had done, but the people who'd been offended against originally, they had not been that interested in going through this healing process. But when they saw this, they listened to this girl's story, and they found out that she was a street child. She lived on the streets, and they saw her mother and saw how much hatred and abuse she got from her mother. And the people who had been offended against became very staunch advocates for this young girl and really got into the healing process. And in 4 years of this Maori system for the juvenile justice system, the people who were put into the juveniles put in detention were reduced by 2/3 in 4 years. And they closed half of the juvenile detention centers in New Zealand.
Lloyd, really, thank you for that story. So I have a tough question, or it's really a question of curiosity, because I'm imagining some people listening to our podcast, I'm trying to put myself in the place of some people who might be listening and say, well, that makes sense, right? That the idea of restoring balance and harmony is the goal. And going back to your original idea of in the West, you know, there's either good or evil. So if you're an evil person, let's just get rid of you. Let's kill you. Let's, you know, put you in prison versus restoring you to harmony, which of course is kind of ironic because at least in the Christian tradition, there's so much about redemption, but we won't go there. I think maybe some of the people who are advocates or just lock them away forgot about that part of it. But here's a question I have. You may or may not know the answer to it, but somebody listening may say, okay, but how do you restore balance with a Ted Bundy, with a sociopath or a psychopath, right? A serial murderer or someone who is a danger to society. And I'm curious if you know what they obviously didn't necessarily have serial murderers or mass murderers the way we have, but undoubtedly they did have people who were a lot harder to deal with. Any sense of what Indigenous people historically did in that case where they had someone who really was a danger to society? Because I imagine most people listening would say, I'm with you. Our system is too punitive, not restorative. But what about that person who is not likely redeemable? What do we do about that in that kind of system? And my psychologist friend, Paul, who works in the prison system in the U.S., I said, you know, are there people who can't, you know, be rehabilitated? And he said, yes, there are people, sociopaths, psychopaths, who literally, there's nothing we could do that we know of that would restore them to where they could live in society. He said it's a small percentage, but I'm just curious what Indigenous wisdom or experience might tell us about that for those who might push back on this idea to the extreme.
Well, I would love to ask an Indigenous friend about that, but all I can do is talk from my understanding. And I've never read any accounts of sociopaths in Indigenous societies. So literally, I can't answer that. But I would say for the people who aren't sociopaths, they go back to the childhood. And our child rearing has so much to do with the people who end up in our criminal justice system. And so the Native peoples would say that their child rearing was all about raising children to recognize their relationship with other people, with everything around them. And if we did that in our society, we'd need a whole lot fewer prisons than we have. And yes, the ultimate punishment, and I shouldn't use that word because I've been told that the Dakota Lakota people don't have any word for punishment, mm-hmm. that in raising children and in their justice system, the concept didn't exist. I mean, that's a telling thing. If you find out what words don't exist in a culture, that tells you concepts that do not exist. Another one that doesn't exist in the Dakota language is revenge. And yet our Bibles, you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. So, but their final, if somebody was not amenable to their justice system, and it was not forced upon them, a typical justice system was kind of an ongoing counseling sort of thing. And there would be people who would not be amenable to it, but they also knew what the consequences were. And the consequences, when the native cultures were what there was in the land, was banishment. Mm-hmm. And banishment was almost a death sentence for people who lived that way, because your language was only with your people. So if you were banished, you could not communicate with other people. And their lives were based upon cooperation and collaboration. And if you were banished, you didn't have that. So you knew that too, which gave you a strong incentive to work with them on the healing process.
Well, a couple of thoughts as you were speaking there. First, you said, I think, a very, really, really important piece, which is what we need to ask, what is it about our society, the way we raise children, even the way we're self-organized as a society, that means we have more people who go to that extreme. And we don't have to even go back to the indigenous peoples. We can go back even to when the three of us were children, and there were fewer serial murderers and fewer child predators, et cetera, than there are now, partly because people didn't move around. In a less urban, more rural society where people stayed in place, again, going back to Janine Benyus's thing about when you stay in place, in a lot of those communities, the community kind of held these people who might have become a danger in a way that doesn't happen in an urban society that we live in now. And what is it about how we are raising children and our lack of community that may produce more of what you're talking about? And I do love that idea, not love the idea of banishment, but the fact that there isn't the word for punishment or revenge, but that to be separate from the community would be the ultimate, you know, you can't really survive psychologically or physically in a more, you know, previous communities to be separate, right? You couldn't really, you might not even stay alive. It's like that. It happens in nature too, in Africa, in the savannah, where there are, if you get kicked out of the herd and you have these males who are suddenly now, you know, orphaned by themselves and they're no longer a part of the herd, they don't survive very long. Mm-hmm. So that is not a punishment. But I love what you said. That's the consequence. And even to talk about the consequence versus punishment is a whole different way to think about, you know, responsibility rather than accountability. Look, you know what the consequences are should you choose to do this. It's not a punishment. It's mm-hmm. the consequence of your choice not You're to right. enter into this process.
Yeah, very much so. And we've, in our culture, focused so much on rights. And the only place I've heard Indigenous people talk about rights is when they're talking about treaty rights. And they aren't talking about individual human rights. They always look at what are my responsibilities as a person. And you talked about, you know, the banishment is a separation from community. Well, I think that's the big thing that's changed since we were young, is that with the urbanization, there has been such a breakdown of community. I know I've read that so many people feel feelings of social isolation every year. And the social isolation is a disease, a dis-ease. It's being uncomfortable where you are. And of course, there's going to be more acting out. And I mean, another big difference with the Indigenous justice system is that, again, because they weren't focusing on what the infraction was, they're looking at every aspect of the individuals involved. And it isn't just the offender, it's the victims too are part of this. How did this impact you? So they're looking at all four aspects of their lives. They're looking at the mental, the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual. So there's a wholeness. And that's one of the things that I really got from David Bohm, because David Bohm saw that the fragmentation that goes on in our culture contributes so much to our inability to get together and see what needs to be done and to agree to do it. And everywhere in our culture, I see fragmentation. And in the indigenous cultures, what I saw was wholeness. I mean, I've been told again and again that indigenous culture after indigenous culture doesn't have any word for economics or for religion, because it's just the whole, an aspect of the whole of life.
And from that perspective, Lord, where do we see some indigenous people or indigenous ways become more visible in today's society?
Well, fortunately, we're beginning to see it in our political system. And Minnesota has been fortunate that we have a lieutenant governor who's Peggy Flanagan, who's an indigenous woman. And I've been told that she holds the highest state office that any indigenous person ever has in the United States. And another way of looking at things is, how can we begin to rebalance the books with the indigenous people who live amongst us? And there was a wonderful story in the paper here just last week that a Native man from one of the northern Minnesota Ojibwe nations was talking about the importance of land and what they were doing around land at one of the large Lutheran churches here in Minneapolis. And after his talk, the minister handed him an envelope, and in the envelope was a check for $250,000 for them to buy back more land. And one of the indigenous tribes here in Minnesota has been able to repurchase 28,000 acres of what originally had been their reservation. And some other things that seem small to us, but from the indigenous people I know, I hear clearly that for 150 years since the end of the Indian Wars, they have been invisible in our culture. And they always talk about that invisibility. So to have somebody like Peggy Flanagan as lieutenant governor is huge for them. And she was a legislator before that. And we have a number of legislators, not a large number, I think it's 3 or 4 this year. And it's interesting that so far in Minnesota, all the indigenous legislators have been women. And it makes sense to me, because they're the ones who can see most clearly what needs to be done. Another thing that may seem small, but Miss Minnesota last year was an indigenous young woman for the very first time. And their culture feels that is being seen. And several years ago, I saw a wonderful documentary called Rumble, how Native Americans rocked the world. And it's the Native American influence in the rising of rock and roll. Jimi Hendrix, as I recall, had a Cherokee grandmother. But from after the Civil War on, and these people talk about being told that there was much mixing of races in slavery, because the original slaves in the United States were Native Americans. And when the slave trade started, it was mostly bringing males over to work, and a lot of the females were Native Americans. So the races were mixed very early on. And after the Civil War, the Native peoples found that they were actually treated, I mean, as god awful as it was, they were treated better to pass as Black than to be recognized as Native American.
Yeah, Lloyd, a couple of things. One on this issue, and then back to the broad issue. As our listeners know, I'm a dual citizen, Canada and the United States, born in America, but mother is Canadian, wife's Canadian. So I spend a lot of time still in both countries. And there's such a contrast in Canada with pretty much the same sordid history around Indigenous people. But there's a whole reconciliation process going on in Canada, almost everywhere now, even in corporations. If you go to a conference or a meeting, people recognize the land that they're on. There's a whole movement around looking squarely at what whites and the dominant European culture did to the indigenous peoples. And it's very much in the public zeitgeist. I often feel in the United States, some Canadian friends ask me, what's it like in the US? And I said, I bet the average American could go months and sometimes years without even thinking about the native peoples. And I think you know, this would be controversial to say, but I think one difference between the two countries is Canada didn't have slavery. In the United States, the black-white divide and what has been done to African Americans, rightly so, has dominated the conversation, but so much so that I think that there's almost forgotten that what we did to the indigenous people. And I think it's interesting when we talk about the othering that even if you look at the abolition movement, there was nowhere near the same kind of Indian rights movement in the United States. So it goes back a long way of this neglect of the what we did to the indigenous people. And I keep coming back to where we began around this otherness, mm-hmm. that when you see other cultures as less than you, other traditions as less than you, there's just not the honoring and respect that breeds curiosity. And I see it even in terms of how, you know, we North Americans see the rest of the world to this day, right? Of kind of like, we've got the way and they don't. So I think this othering is very powerful. And I think the way in the United States, we've almost forgotten about indigenous people entirely is a tragedy we rarely talk about, because it's hardly in the zeitgeist is the reality in America to this day. Only now are we starting to pay attention to it again. And it's more curious about what we can learn from them rather than really looking squarely at what we did to them as well.
Yes. Yeah. And here in Minneapolis, we are hearing land acknowledgments quite commonly. We go to the Guthrie Theater, and they start with actually a very good land acknowledgment. And the Guthrie did a wonderful thing. Let's see, it would be about 3 years ago. They turned their main stage over one weekend, and they had gotten some donated money. And for a year, they had been working with indigenous peoples, and they brought in artists and storytellers. And the coaches at the Guthrie were working with these people to work something up to present on stage that would share their stories. And so one weekend, the Guthrie Theater gave its main stage over to these people. And I know my partner and I went on the Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening, and it was just so moving. And I afterwards told one of my indigenous friends, a young Dakota woman, that had known about it. And she went the next day. And the next time I saw her, she said she was just in tears during the entire time to see the acknowledgement of her people and to see their story from this place of prominence. The Guthrie is, you know, it's probably the most prominent cultural place, venue in the Twin Cities. And so this friend of mine said, oh, she's so glad I told her. She was in tears the entire time.
So good to hear.
Yeah.
Yes. And one aspect I have become more aware of as I read, with your help, some of the books on indigenous worldviews, is this notion of becoming more fully human. How do we become more fully human? And could you give us that sense from your own understanding of the indigenous ways?
Well, I'm reminded of Meg Wheatley on her website. I think she says, if whatever the problem is, community is the answer. And basically, that's what becoming more fully human is recognizing our relationship and striving for right relationship. And that means to be mindful and to be present. And it means to withhold judgment. I'm thinking of what John has been saying about the othering, that if we can step back and withhold judgment and see what is there. And what I invite people to do is, we're so used to these concepts that we have, rather than dwelling in the concepts, look at what the outcomes are and what outcome we would like to have. And is that concept likely to get us to that outcome? I mean, and just a classic example is the criminal justice system. There is no way that our punitive justice system can get us where we would like to be. And that story of separation in which we've grown up, there's no way that it can get us to a peaceful society where we respect and honor one another, where we respect and honor our planet Earth. So it's really about slowing down and being present and just suspending our judgments a bit and thinking about where we would like to go as a people. And without that approach, I don't know that there is any way forward. And for me, my primary practice has been 4 years ago, I had an opportunity to go on a water walk. And this is started by Grandmother Josephine of the Lake Superior Ojibwe. And she passed away a couple of years ago. But she started something like 15 or 16 years ago, these water walks to pray for the water. And for all Indigenous people, they know that water is life. Without water, there is no life on this planet. Without water, there is no civilization on this planet. And to pray for the water. And there's an Ojibwe elder in town here, Sharon Day, who I just fortunately got to know 5 years ago. And she's been leading water walks. She Mother Josephine knew Sharon and called her. And Sharon went to her elders, and she was trained as a water protector. And she was given ceremonies that she could use with white people. These aren't old in Ojibwe ceremonies. That were ones that were created that she could share with anybody. And so she started these water walks. Her first one was down the Mississippi. And the year I got to know her, they walked the Missouri, which is the longest river in the United States. And the following year, and about 8 years ago, Sharon decided, well, why should we just do this on these long river walks in the summer? We'll start. So every Sunday we meet at Hidden Falls Park, which is a park below the bluffs of the Mississippi on the St. Paul side of the river. And at 9 o'clock, we gather there and do ceremony to pray for the water, which is, of course, praying for life and praying for our planet and praying for each of us. And I experience such a sense of the sacred and such love there. We talk about our water family there. And I'm constantly amazed at the personal things that people will share when we're meeting in ceremony. But 4 years ago, I got to walk the Wisconsin River, which is a 375-mile river. And when we're walking, the water carrier carries a copper vessel. We start up at the headwaters of the river. We fill this copper vessel, as well as others, to allow for evaporation. And then in the Ojibwe tradition, the women are the water protectors, the water carriers. The men are welcomed along and they protect the women and they carry the eagle staff. And generally you walk a mile at a time. So it's a relay and the water just keeps moving. You know, as you're changing hands, you just walk alongside the person who has the water, takes it and continue on. And that's in recognizing that if water stops flowing, it becomes stagnant and it is not healthy. So during the water walk, it's always moving. And it was about the middle of the water walk. I was walking first thing one morning. We were in a really marshy area. So there were dead frogs all over the place, roadkill. And when you're walking, you carry a medicine pouch that has tobacco in it, and you sprinkle water. You sprinkle on any water that you walk across. You sprinkle on the remains of any life that you walk across. So I was walking with Sharon, and she's sprinkling tobacco like crazy and pointing to me here, there, you know, don't miss those. So I'm running around like crazy, sprinkling my tobacco on all the frogs there. And about the middle of our mile together, it just hit me. It's like things slowed down for me. And I realized what this water walk is about is a reverence and a respect for life as I had never experienced before. And so that's what I get to experience on the water walks. Now, the water walks, the long walks, aren't in the wintertime, but this meeting on the Mississippi is year-round. The weather doesn't stop the people, so we get to meet there. And I've had such marvelous experiences with that, including with a Muslim woman from Turkey who joined us this last summer.
Lloyd, what a beautiful story. And as in life, time touches us gently. We could talk about this for hours, but we so appreciate you being here. Alon, you have one more question? We're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Yes, we can take just a couple more minutes. Lloyd, you know, we're talking about regeneration in this podcast a number of times. So we wonder how do you personally, you just mentioned the experience with the water ceremony, but how do you personally try to live a more regenerative life? We ask that question from everyone.
Yes, it's really about, as I've said, focusing on relationships and trying to be gentler and kinder in my relationships. And one of the things, too, that you hear a lot about in New Age sorts of things, but Native people's practice is expressing gratitude. In any meetings that I've ever been to that have been conducted by Indigenous people, they start with prayer. And most of their prayer is expressing gratitude for all this abundance that we have been given. I mean, the way they look at it, which I'm learning slowly to be a bit better job at, is everything that we need to live a life is given to us. And what greater miracle can there be than that? And even peoples who lived in what we see as being relatively barren areas, the San people, the Kalahari, the Aboriginal people of Australia, who live in some of the harshest climates on the earth, see themselves as gifted in abundance. And that one thing that I keep coming to, which is not to this question, but the short-term view that we have that John talked about. In 300 years of practicing our approach to science and our approach to the Western life, we have brought our planet to the verge of physical collapse. The Aboriginal people and the San people, their cosmology has maintained them for 60 to 80,000 years. And we can't even comprehend that kind of time frame. And to us, our 300 years seems like a very long time.
Wonderful. Well, again, Lloyd, thank you so much for the good work you're doing and for sharing with us today. Is there a website if people want to find out more about you they can go to?
No,
okay. How refreshing. Wonderful. Well, look, thank you so much for your being with us today. Some really profound thoughts. I think I love your quote of Meg Wheatley. I'm a big fan of Meg. Whatever the question is, community is the answer. I think of the implications of some of what we talked about today about balance and harmony. And if we had a different attitude towards all the rest of nature, towards other people and cultures and what we might learn from them. And I think it'd be remiss in saying that none of what we talked about today means that all of Western culture and all of kind of European North American culture was somehow evil. That's the exact same kind of dualism that we want to be against. But to me, it's what can we learn from the people who lived in place in harmony, as you said, for so many years? What can we learn from a justice system that is different from ours? And so much we have focused on what these other cultures can learn from us. And I think what an important thing it is now for us to stop and ask, what can we learn from them? Because there's so many things you pointed to that can be so important for the challenges that we face in the way forward. Alon, I'll give you a chance for a final comment, then I'll close this out.
Yes, it's both learn and live experience. And that's what I'm learning a lot by having more conversations with Lloyd, is that the willingness to just take it in, yes, learn, but live it, is really the thing. So thank you again, Lloyd. You've been wonderful.
And so now I want to thank you for listening to us today, for giving us a part of your lifetime to learn and grow with us. If you like what you heard, please share it and let us know. If you liked what you heard today, but you think we could do better, or you have a guest that you think we should invite on, or a topic we should explore, we'd love to hear from you. It's so exciting for Jim, our producer, and Alon and myself to hear from you. We'd love to engage and find out more of your thoughts. So for now, thank you. Thank you, Lloyd. And we wish all of you a great day and look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast. Thanks again for joining us.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Elders Action Network and Blueprint NGO. Elders Action Network is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Blueprint is catalyzing a global conversation about the state and impact of men in the world. Together, they are mobilizing men to be a force for good. Their website is blueprint.ngo. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation podcast, which you can listen to on Podbean and Apple Podcasts.